Lane Gardening for the Gulf Coast. With Mobile's award-winning garden expert and chief horticultural advisor for Mobile Botanical Gardens, Bill Finch. We'll talk about living and growing on the Gulf Coast. Now, your personal yard and garden consultant, here's Bill Finch.
Hey, welcome back. It's the Gulf Coast Sunday morning with Plain Gardening. If you think that it has been raining, we've had more heavy rainfall in the past few years than we used to have. You're right. You're absolutely right. You're right to think that. You're right to perceive that if you have a memory old enough to remember what it would, because we've seen more heavy rainfall events than we used to see. And there's data to support that now. It's pretty clear. It's a huge whopping increase in heavy rainfall events. We've seen some increase in rainfall, not quite much. I mean, we already get a lot of rainfall, right? We've always gotten a lot of rainfalls. So we've seen a little bit of an increase, a few inches, a couple or 3 inches, 4 inches maybe, in rainfall total. But more and more of our rainfall is occurring in big glumps, just big, huge, just all at once. 3 inches in an hour, 5 inches in a couple or three hours, 7 inches like we had the other day where cars are floating down Dolphin Street. These are real things that are happening, and they have an effect on your garden, and that's what I wanted to alert you to and to get you to think about. Listen, and then you're saying, yeah, we've had more of these heavy rainfall events, and yet, God, why is my garden still suffering from drought? Why is things drying out so bad? Well, listen, let me tell you, it's very clear that the flooding is what's making the droughts worse on your garden. It works many, many ways. And I wish I could break down all the ways that all of this excess flooding causes your garden to be more susceptible to drought. It just is perfect sense if you think about how soil works, where your structure is, if you understand there's a soil community. I didn't talk about this, but let me tell you, there's a group of bad actors down there in the soil from your perspective. We like to call them pathogenic fungi. These pathogenic are, and some of them are water molds. These pathogenic creatures, they are not good for you. They're pathogens, they're diseases, if you want to call them that. They thrive in low oxygen conditions when the particles between your soil get filled up with water. And so they're doing all kind of damage to your plants during the flood periods, wrecking the roots, just damaging the roots something terrible. Not only the flooding keeps the roots from going very deep, but then suddenly you get all these pathogenic guys in there, and they're just tearing up the roots. Now, the plant may survive that the while it's wet, but as soon as it dries out, their roots are just decimated. They have very little ability to absorb moisture. So anytime there's a decline in moisture because the roots have been just destroyed by these destroyers of plants like Phytophthora, that's literally what it means, Phytophthora. When these destroyers of plants start working on the roots, when it dries out, boom. So people said to me, God, you know, I got this hickory and it's just suddenly died. What is it? Is it the drought? Well, you know, I don't think it's the drought. I think it may be the flooding that predisposed that tree to be very susceptible to even a mild drought. So how do you deal with drought? How do you deal with the fact that your plants are going to end up dying during the dry times? You understand that the damage was done during the floods, and you build your yard to deal with the flooding. If you build your yard to deal with the flooding, and you do it smart, it's going to take a lot more severe drought before it affects your yard. That's what's very important. That's what I'm trying to drive home today. Hey, Chris, thank you for calling in. We had a conversation last week, didn't we?
Yes, Bill, my wife is determined to make something with the pine needles and pine cones around here other than putting them in my blueberry. I wanted to ask you to talk about that a little bit this morning, and then maybe if you could, I'll get off here, but I was wondering what's the best way to get some of that organic matter you're talking about. And if I could, too, I've had a real good crop of chestnuts this year. Well, I'm not sure about fruiting on a chestnut tree. I really appreciate you, Bill. We're listening out here at Pace.
All right, Chris, good to hear from you. I made Chris call in again this week because he sent me this question last week. He sent me this weird little thing from, it was from Soviet Georgia. It's not Soviet anymore. Well, let's hope it doesn't become Soviet again. Let's hope our country doesn't somehow help it to become Soviet again. But it's just good old Georgia over there, not Georgia next to us, but Georgia over there next to Russia and the Ukraine. Cool place, Georgia. And in Georgia, the country of Georgia, they make up this jam made with pine cones. Now, ain't that something? I saw a picture of it. As they like to say, I seen it done. And it's kind of cool. And the pine cones, I noticed in the jam, are these little bitty pine cones, little tiny pine cones, not much bigger than a joint of your finger, that are from, I assume, Georgian pine trees, which are very different than our pine trees. And they put them in while they're green. It was fascinating. And it was not... You know, it. I don't think they were promoting it as a particularly appetizing delicacy, because one person described it as somewhat pine sol like, a bit like drinking pine sol mixed with honey, and I imagine that's what it is. And supposedly it had some medicinal qualities. I'm not sure what those medicinal effects were. I don't know. And I can't speak for that. I would say that our pines are very different. I think it would be very hard to put a longleaf, to make a jam out of a longleaf pine cone, or even a shortleaf pine cone, which is small, one of our smallest pine cones, but very large compared to theirs. So... It's a little different. But what I wanted to talk about was the fact that we did, and please don't, you old-timers, don't quote Ewell Gibbons. It's not funny anymore. But we did in the South used to eat pine trees. And we ate them for a lot of reasons and for a lot of things. One of the interesting things was one of the really special things to me, and I haven't tried it. One of these days I am. Was they used longleaf seedlings in the days when longleaf seedlings were so prolific you could think about doing things like that. They used longleaf seedlings for salads. Ooh. I can imagine that salad had some bite, but you know, it was something that was done. The other thing is that longleaf seeds from the cones are actually quite delicious. They're a little more piney than the seeds you get from the Mediterranean pine trees that we make. That we make the little pinoli out of, the little nuts, pine nuts that are used in things like pesto and things like that. But they're quite good, and people used to eat the seeds a lot, and so does every animal. I mean, it's one of those things, you know, that longleaf seeds, every animal out there would, in the old days, they'd kill for a longleaf seedling, longleaf seed, because the seeds were so incredibly good. Yeah. And it might even be interesting to pre-sprout some of those longleaf seedlings if we could find enough of them. So, yeah, there's a history of eating pines, and that's good. Let me also remind you that what pines were used for was that one of the other things that comes from pines, terpenes. Let me use that word, terpene. T-E-R-P-E-N-E. It's related to the word we get turpentine from. Terpenes are certain aromatic compounds that can be good for you or that can be somewhat toxic. And it's interesting. For some plants, they're designed to be toxic. Humans learn to eat those things in spite of that and to make use of them. Rosemary has lots of terpenes in it, for example. And those terpenes, the fragrance of that rosemary is designed to... Well, look at this. I got to take a break. But we're going to come back. We're going to talk a little bit more about these pine trees. And I'm going to try to remember all the other questions Chris asked me. You think I'll do it? I don't know. I got a couple of other questions folks asked. We're going to get to them as well.
You can take all the tea in China. Put it in a big brown bag for me. Sail right round all the seven oceans. Drop it straight into the deep blue sea. She's as sweet as Tupelo honey. She's an angel of the first degree. She's as sweet.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Hold all these questions in my head. Let me just real quickly say that Just Fruits and Exotics, J-U-S-T, Fruits, F-R-U-I-T-S, and Exotics, E-X-O-T-I-C-S, Just Fruits and Exotics. Why do I keep repeating that phrase over and over and over again? Because it's the name of a nursery. Just Fruits and Exotics. Believe it or not, that's their name. Been dealing with them for a long time. They're over in Crawfordville, Florida. And if you're looking for fruit trees, I highly recommend that you look at their catalog on the internet. I ordered from them because they got great stuff. They got great stuff that you can't find in other places, including some loquats. For example, Taxman and I and others have been talking about how do we find cultivars of loquats that have special qualities. There you go. And, you know, we've been talking about figs and fig varieties. We've been talking about persimmons and persimmon varieties. Just Fruits and Exotics.
May I read David's text to you?
Yes.
David, who has quite a sense of humor, basically said after hearing your description for making pine cone jams for Hubble's Hearth, he says after your description, I think I'll leave that to the Soviet Georgians. He's going to stick to his homegrown Tabasco pepper jelly for now,
right.
Which is probably pretty good.
But listen, I think pines are really actually can be quite good. There are people, and if you have not had what is the name of that Greek wine that is really 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 terrible, but we have it at Greek Fest anyway. There's probably better quality versions of it that is aged in pine casks. It has that very pine-like quality. It can be interesting. And the pine flavoring up to a certain point, it can actually be quite interesting. One of the things I want to say to finish that discussion up, if you want to be careful about there's certain things. Pine seeds are going to be just fine. I think pine needles you're not going to be able to eat enough of. But one of the problems about green cones, green pine cones, may be the amount of terpenes they have, and terpenes sometimes can tend towards turpentine, and turpentine is toxic to humans if they drink it. It's a great thing, turpentine, a really good thing. Just don't. If you're going to experiment, be careful. Here's what I do think. I think there's a long history of eating pine seeds. I think that's a fine thing to do. It's a great thing to do. And if you can gather the seeds from a longleaf pine, you're going to have an incredible, incredible pinoli. It's going to be really good. It's going to taste different than the Mediterranean, but it's going to be really good. If you can eat young needles, the youngest little seedlings, you can make a salad out of that. It's a traditional thing. My dad used to say, and I said, Dad, you know, what was it like? It used to run hogs through the woods, which wasn't a great thing. But they'd catch them up each year. They'd catch them up, and then they'd slaughter the hogs. In South Mississippi and South Alabama, that's what folks did. And I said, boy, I bet those hogs were good. And he said, son, they tasted like pine trees. He said it was like eating pine trees. Because the hogs would go through the woods eating up all the longleaf seedlings and the roots, particularly the roots of young longleaf. So the hogs would do it, but it could be pretty strong. So I don't know what to do, but it's fun to think about pine trees. That's why I wanted Chris to call. Chris had another question about pruning chestnuts. You know, Chris, I don't honestly know about pruning chestnuts. I've never seen one pruned. I would say that it's probably not the wisest thing to do. I don't think that it needs pruning because they're kind of low. They're not, the limbs are low. So I don't think you're going to have a big problem there. But yeah, let's don't prune the. I'll look, but I don't think you need to prune a chestnut tree. Where do you get organic matter? Let me try to do that one real quick. Leaves are an incredible source of organic matter. Pieces of wood are an incredible source of organic matter. Pine bark, if you want to know what to do with your pines, pine bark is a great source of organic matter if you need an emergency supply, and a lot of people sell it. They actually, Retsina, thank you, David. Retsina is our pine-flavored wine. If you were looking for something to do with pine bark makes great emergency organic matter, and I do that. But organic matter can come from many, many sources. Don't make it hard. The easiest and best source is leaves. They're incredible. Hay can be a great organic matter source. I'm using that a lot too, where hay is available. If you're out in the country, hay can be a big, real advantage. Great source of organic matter. Growing rye and cutting the rye down is a great source of organic matter. Wood pieces that are rotten, and wood rots very quickly here, great source of organic matter. All of these things have to be used, and we need a lot of it. That's the way forests and fields and have worked for, well, about 400 million years, to be honest. It's about that long. That's how they work. That's what plants are adapted to. All of these things rotting in the ground. Plant parts rotting in the ground. And all the things that eat up the plant parts rotting in the ground and turning into incredibly rich black topsoil. That's where the organic matter comes from. JP, I'm sorry you had to sit so long while I ran through all that. What's up?
Two things. Hi, Bill. Hey, won't keep you long. This time of the year, what's the best thing to plant the garden vegetables I'm thinking of?
Yeah, so it's good to talk about this, JP. Thank you. Listen, if you've got broccoli plants, put them out this weekend. It's perfect. It is the perfect time. If you've got cabbage plants, put them out this weekend. It is the perfect time. If you've got collard plants, put them out this weekend. It's the best time. You got kale, put it out this weekend. It's the best time. It's a great time to put out mustard plants. It's a great time to put out parsley plants. Parsley will last all winter long. It's a great time to put out cilantro. It's a great time to put out lettuce. It's a great time to put out arugula. You can sow it from seeds. Just sow it. It's a great time to sow the seeds from radish.
Is it too late to plant by seed most of the above mentioned?
It's too late for broccoli. I'll just say it's too late for broccoli. It's not too late for kale. You'll do fine with kale. It's not too late for collards, though you're going to miss part of the best season. It's not too late for turnips. You can do that for them from seed. It's not radish. It's a great time to plant them from seed. They'll do just fine. Carrots, it's a great time to do from seed. They'll do just fine this time of year. There's some special things you need to do to get those carrots up, but they'll do fine from seed this time of year. Arugula is great from seed. It's perfect from seed. Mustards are great from seed. And you know what else? I think it's probably too late for American cabbages, but Chinese cabbages like pak choi and bok choy, pak choy, and Chinese cabbage, those do very well from seed, and you can sow them this time of year. That's a pretty big selection.
Okay. Got about 10 acres you can lend me.
You know, you don't need it. You don't need it. Right. You got, you just plant intensively. Don't plant in rows. Plant in beds.
Yeah. Okay.
About 3 feet wide, as you know. And that's a, you can handle a lot of plants in a relatively small space.
Okay. Thanks, Bill. I appreciate your words. You have a great rest of the day.
JP, you too. I hope you get to plant some. So I hope y'all heard that. You know, there's some other things we can plant too, but it's time. It's that time. If you wait much later than now, the days are going to be too short for those plants to grow. It won't be the temperature, it'll be the shortening days. Another thing we have to think about when we're doing seasons. We're going to be back. Give us a call, 251-343-0106.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Rain, rain on my face. Hasn't stopped.
Hey, welcome back. Gulf Coast Sunday morning with Plain Gardening. Listen, let me get to some of the questions that we had, and I've been able to pull out of the text this morning. Somebody sent me a picture about their boxwoods, and the question was about boxwoods. You can't see me, but when I say the word boxwoods, every time I say it, I put my two fingers in the air and do two little strokes around it to indicate that that is in quote marks, that it's not really a boxwood. But we call them boxwoods. They're actually Chinese hollies and various kinds that have some vague resemblance to boxwoods. Real boxwoods, by the way, probably wouldn't last very long at all here on the Gulf Coast. And the Chinese hollies that we use as replacements for boxwoods don't last much longer. They are very poorly adapted to Gulf Coast conditions. They get severe diseases, root diseases mostly. There may be some stem diseases as well. The diseases have names like Pythium and Phytophthora. I'd like to say those names out loud. Pythium and Phytophthora. And those diseases will just devastate the plant. What are you going to do? You going to give it some medicine? No. No. There's not a thing you can do. You just can't. I mean, we don't have medicines for plants like we do for people. And it would be prohibitively expensive if we did to deal with those kinds of diseases. They're in the soil for the most part. It has to do with the fact that we have a very rainy climate and that we have a very short winter and that our soils stay warm for a long time, and all of these things work against Chinese hollies. And so you're beginning to see the death of those plants. It will happen a piece at a time as the roots begin to, and portions of the stem begin to suffer from the various diseases that affect those Chinese hollies that we plant and call boxwoods. Here's the remedy for that. Replace them, begin replacing them with plants that are more resistant. And let me tell you, one of those is yaupon. Dwarf yaupons can be very resistant to these diseases. They're not absolutely resistant. Sometimes they'll get problems over after time, but they'll last a heck of a lot longer than those Chinese hollies. And my favorite is, I hope we can still get it, is Oscar's, Little Oscar, we call it. Oscar Greenleaf. It's a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful dwarf yaupon holly, incredibly dark green leaves. I love to see it. It is, you know, you can see it. When you see that plant, you say, Little Oscar, because it is so distinctive. It doesn't grow very much, has very dark leaves. I hope Martin van der Giessen is still growing it. And I hope that we can, perhaps you can get it through the Mobile Botanical Gardens. You can ask some of our places like A Bloom and Seed and Feed, Fairhope Seed and Feed, if they have Little Oscar, tell them they can get it from van der Giessen Nursery. It's a great, great plant, and it replaces, it's a dwarf yaupon, Y-A-U-P-O-N, which is a native plant, unlike the Chinese hollies. And in this case, this native plant has a lot more resistance to our conditions here. It's very resistant to these this high rainfall environment. It does not get Pythium and Phytophthora nearly as readily. It doesn't get stem diseases nearly as readily. And that's what you do. And there's really no other solution. Also, one other thing. When you plant these things next to a house, anything next to a house, and you got a lot of them, the drainage, there's severe drainage issues there. Almost always. The soil is bad around a house, and within the first 6 feet of a house, and particularly within the first 3 feet. When you've got a sidewalk between the house and where you've got these planted, I think you may have that in this case, you get particularly severe drainage issues. Usually the soil is very compacted. When you replant, add some organic matter. You don't have to dig it in. Break the soil where these things were. Just take a fork, a garden fork, four-tine garden fork. Crack that soil. Just don't turn it. You don't even need to turn it. It's useless. It's a bad thing. Just crack the soil when you're getting ready to replant. And then put about 3 inches, okay? I'm holding my fingers. I'm going to call that 4 inches. 4 inches of organic matter. All right? Just put it on the top and then plant. Don't dig it in. Just leave it on the top. Then plant those yaupons in that. Plant them so that they're even the top. And then keep adding that little bit of pine bark mulch over time so that the level of the soil stays up, because it's going to decompose. They'll do really well. So there it is. That's the thing. These, you know, I know people will sell them to you. You can, I know that landscapers, I mean, that house builders put them in all the time. And why do house builders put them in? Because people who build your house, people who do framing, people who know plumbing, people who know electricity, they are experts on plants, right? They've had tons of trainings in what plants do well around your house, right? Oh, please. Just because your contractor put them in there don't mean they're supposed to be there, because they don't know nothing about plants generally, and I don't expect them to. I expect them to know how to do the electricity and the plumbing, right? And sometimes they do, but, you know, Chinese hollies, not good plants. Yaupons are great. You can use them to replace your plants for those things. Another question that I had that I'm trying to get back to that came to us by via text. Dan has been saying, you know, Dan wants to know trees and shrubs of the Southeast, and he's heard me talk about it a lot, and he just says, okay, I want to know. I want to know what I'm looking at, because I say, you know, and as I said to him and to you, we live in the center of tree diversity in North America. I know you find that hard to believe, because you think this is all about Auburn football and Alabama football, right? That's why we have Alabama, is so we can have two football teams, right? That's the only reason for Alabama's existence. Okay, great. Well, there's another reason for Alabama's existence. We got University of South Alabama football team, right? Wrong. Listen, Alabama is the center of forest diversity in North America. It is incredible, the diversity of tree species. Unbelievable. So you're out there thinking, oh, I got to learn what an oak tree looks like. There are 40 species of oaks in Alabama, folks. You don't even have the words for it. It's incredible. We're the center of hickory diversity globally. We're the center of magnolia diversity nationally. Center of oak diversity nationally. I could go through. We're Georgia and Alabama, center of rhododendron diversity. It goes on and on and on. So you got to have the center of grass diversity in eastern North America is Mobile County. Believe it or not, Mobile County is, and it ain't Bermuda grass. It ain't St. Augustine we're talking about. We're talking about things like, about a half dozen at least species of andropogon, more than that, 7, 8, 10 species of andropogon. These are the things that we call blue stems. And then there's little blue stem, which is another thing altogether. And there's Indian grass, and then there's panic grasses of all kinds, and then there's switch grasses, and then there's gamma grasses, which are really cool, and they're all over the place. And then there's, the list goes on and on. Don't get me started. So, Aristida. Ooh, there's another good grass group that we're really good at. So we got all these different things, and we can't identify them. So how do you identify them? Am I going on? I'm going on, but I mean to. Dan, here's some books to start with. I mentioned, you know, Duncan and Duncan has a good book on trees that I think is still in print, Trees of the Southeastern United States. It's a good place to start. Got some good pictures, pretty good descriptions. One of my old friends and something of a mentor, Bob Godfrey, Robert Godfrey. There's a famous book by Bob Godfrey, if you can ever find it, if you really get into this. Godfrey and Wooten. Robert Godfrey, Godfrey, G-O-D-F-R-E-Y, and Wooten, W-O-O-T-E-N, Trees of the Southeastern United States, Trees and Shrubs of the Southeastern United States. It's a great way to start. It's mostly illustrations, but it's a pretty thorough guide to the trees you're most likely to encounter along the Gulf Coast. And it's a pretty thick book. It's got a lot of stuff in there, but it's pretty cool. It's a pretty good guide. And that gets the trees and shrubs. So both of those are very good. So those are two really good places to start. You know, somebody said, so one of the things I think Dan was saying was, and it kind of, I labored under this misimpression for a long time too. Well, listen, let's make this easy. Let's just make the trees that we're going to see on the Gulf Coast. That's going to be a smaller book, right? Wrong. Because the trees in Southwest Alabama are really the trees of North America, at least in Eastern North America. There are very few trees that occur in Eastern North America that don't occur in Southwest Alabama. Wow. So it's kind of tricky. Kind of tricky. But those are some books. I hope that helps. Ooh, Bambula. I love this music. This was good old Mobile music in about 1780. This is a version of a very famous dance that was popular around Mobile.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
No, listen to that. We're back. We got a little bit of time left. We're gonna try to answer some questions really quickly. Alicia, listen, let me tell you. The great thing about don't second guess your citrus. That is the best thing I can tell you. Don't second guess your citrus when it comes to pruning. Your citrus is going to do really wonderful things for you. Yes, you're going to get these big limbs that lean over. They're great. You know why they're great? And you know why we've cultivated citrus to that? It's because it makes it really easy to pick. Imagine if that limb went straight up in the air. If your limbs look like they've got too much weight on them, it's because the fruit is too heavy. The fruit load is too heavy. So what you want to do is don't prune the limb, thin the fruit. That's the only time you want to second guess your citrus is how much fruit it sets. Thin the fruit so that you won't do stress, but do not prune those limbs. It will be a big mistake. It's always a mistake to prune a citrus, even with those long limbs. If they're leaning over now because there's a lot of extra weight on them because of the fruit. If the fruit is closer, if you've got citrus and the fruit is closer than 6 inches, in other words, you want your fruit to be 6 inches apart. If it's closer than that, it's going to put a lot of pressure on the limb. And so thin that fruit off. Just cut some of the fruit off. You know what? We have some smart listeners, and one of them said, you know, I used some of those green fruits as lemons, and they were absolutely delicious. So here's what you do. If you got too many fruit clustered on your satsuma, and that limb is leaning way, way over, and you're worried about it, don't prune the limb. Thin the fruit, and use the fruit to make a nice lemonade. It'll be tart, but it'll have a little sweetness. It'll have a real character, whether it's a satsuma, whether it's a Meyer's lemon. It'll be great. And just use some of it now so that each of the fruits are 6 inches apart. You'll take the stress off that limb. You won't have to prune the limb. The limb will come back up. It's going to sort itself out. They always do. I have never, ever pruned a live limb on my citrus. I prune out dead wood sometimes, but I never prune a live limb. And it works great. It works great, particularly for the citrus you're looking at. And the more it puts out those limbs that lean over, the better off it is, because you can pick the fruit. You know, imagine if it held that fruit way up in the middle of the air. That'd be a big problem. But yeah, don't prune those citrus. That's the best advice I can give you. Tara, I'm listening. What's up?
I hope you can help me. I got some questions regarding soaking some things and whether or not now is okay to plant them.
Yep, you got to hurry now because we only got a little bit of time.
All right, sugar snaps, nasturtiums, and parsley. It says soak overnight, but I've got an additional question about that. I read it somewhere in one of my books that you can also freeze the parsley and that it will come up almost overnight when you do. The nasturtiums, I can't remember. Is it just supposed to be 3 or 4 hours maybe to soak them? And we have the slam weather. We're going from 95 degrees to freezing as usual. The sugar snaps, should I plant them today? Should I soak them before I do?
Okay, sugar snaps, do not plant. Do not plant. Will do you no good. Wait until December to plant sugar snaps. That's easy.
Okay.
Nasturtiums. Here's the thing. I think when the temperatures are fairly warm, if you soak the seeds you can pour a little bit of, not boiling water, but, you know, moderately hot water.
Okay.
Over them and let them sit for half a day. They'll probably imbibe enough water to germinate. The other way to do it, which I've done, it's a little more tedious is to use fingernail clippers, you remember, and just kind of snip off a little piece of the shell so that it can imbibe water. The third way to do it is just to plant the seed. And if you keep the soil moist, you know, it germinates almost as fast doing it that way, particularly with this hot weather. With warm weather, it's actually going to germinate faster. So either one of those three ways, I probably would soak them, just soak them, and with in some hot water and see if that doesn't help. With parsley, you know, it depends on the variety and the freshness of the seed. I've had parsley, I had some parsley the other day. I had some parsley varieties come up in 4 days. It's astonishing. Wow. Boom. Every one of them. I've never seen anything like it. And then I had some flat-leaf parsley that just barely came up after 15 days. It was annoying.
Well, of course, that's what I got.
Yeah. And so, but there's some new varieties. There's a variety I got called Plione, P-L-I-E-N. I can't get all my vowels in the right place. P-L-I-E-O-N-E or something like that.
Right.
P-L-E-I-O-N-E. And it came up very fast and very vigorously without any extra trouble. The fact that the ground is warmer means that parsley comes up faster than it would in spring anyway. So I don't know that it's a big benefit to soak it, but you can certainly try. The warm ground is going to mean that it's going to germinate faster.
I'll soak some, and I'll leave some unsoaked and see what happens.
See what happens.
Right?
You're welcome. Good to hear from
you.
Thank you. All right. Yeah, so there it is. You know, if you're going to, I wish I had time. I got 2 minutes to tell you how to grow carrots, which is silly because I barely know how to do it myself. But let me tell you, you got to keep those carrots moist. Put them on the ground. I've decided putting a screen on the top of them. Just after you sow your carrots, sow them thinly, soak the ground first, then put your carrot seeds in, then get a screen. Get a screen, like a window screen, if you get, you know, and just a little piece, put that over it, try to weight the edges down. Not a screen in a frame, but just the screening itself. Put it over the ground, weight the edges down. It'll get enough light to germinate, but it'll be very hard for insects to get to it. You won't get the insect damage that you usually see this year. That's one way of doing it. There's some other things, but for some reason, lots of insects go after those. The carrots come up quickly if they're moist. They come up really quickly this time of year, but the insects go after them. They love the taste of carrots, those little pesky little insects. They love the taste of carrots. So you got to put a little screen over them so that the insects can't get to them as easily. That's one suggestion. Some people let their carrots, some actually put a board over their carrot where they put the carrot seeds in to keep them extra moist. I think that's a little bit of a problem for several reasons. You got to be really alert when you do that, but I think the screen will help you. You could also use an insect row cover, which is specially designed for it. If you want to do that, it's kind of a white thing. It allows light transmission but doesn't allow insects through. But you know, there's several ways to do it, but there's a thing on sowing carrots. They come up really rapidly. Radish seeds, man, you just put them in the ground. They're going to come up like gangbusters. They are absolutely incredible. If you haven't grown radishes before, big radishes, gosh, we should talk about that. But I don't have any time. It's been fun. We're going to be back next week. Tune in.
Me and my best friend Lillian and her blue tick hound dog Gideon, sitting on the front porch, cooling in the shed, singing every song the radio played.